Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
All the hairs went up on my neck and on my arms, and I felt as if I wasn't with something. I felt briefly as if I was in that cabinet with someone.
In this podcast, we're setting sail in an incredible bit of ancient kit, which quite simply has the power to take your breath away. Found by chance and rescued in the nick of time. Built with ancient techniques and astonishing skill. Strong and proud, with an amazing story to tell. The oldest known seagoing boat in the whole world. I'm stepping out across Britain to discover 100 remarkable places that have shaped you, me, and the whole world. I'm Neil Oliver, and this is my love letter to the British Isles.
Last week, Neil, you took us to Wales, to the largest known prehistoric copper mine on the planet, a mine that helped power the world's Bronze Age. Where are we this week?
Today we're going to one of the most unmistakable and instantly recognisable landmarks in the whole of the British Isles, which is to say, the White Cliffs of Dover. However, we're here not to see the place, but an object. A magical artefact with amazing presence. It's called the Dover Boat. Dover is the world's busiest ferry port. It's obviously, for the longest time, a very important and instantly familiar point of destination and departure for people coming and going, because it's our half of the narrowest crossing to mainland Europe. Dover-Calais, everybody knows about it. And Dover has mattered, has been important for thousands of years at least. Okay, it's always been how people, once the Storega slide had happened, once we were an archipelago with water in between us and the continent, which happened 8,000 years ago, people have had to come to us over the water. And the shortest water journey is between Calais and Dover, okay? So Dover's just always been, it's embedded in everybody's understanding of how to get here. And by here, I mean our archipelago. So it's topped, of course, by Dover Castle, but much more instantly recognisable are the cliffs, the White Cliffs of Dover. Probably always famous, but certainly immortalised by the song, you know, there'll be bluebirds over the White Cliffs of Dover. Which is, you know, synonymous with Britain's battle against Germany and the rest of the Axis enemies during World War II. It's hard, you know, if you imagine, you know, a duel between a Spitfire and a Messerschmitt, you know, in the Battle of Britain. You almost unconsciously, you make it play out in a blue sky above the White Cliffs of Dover. It's just iconic.
The White Cliffs have always been an important marker, haven't they?
Yeah, for the longest time, it would have been the obvious place to come to. In the days of early navigation, you know, if you were departing continental Europe in your little boat and your little ship, and you were intent on coming to the Long Island of Britain, you'd have been doing it by eye. And so you would aim for the White Cliffs, because they're a landmark. You know, they're the easiest thing to see. And it would have been, if you were coming here as a trader or if you were coming home, it would have been with great relief that you glimpsed the White Cliffs, because you knew you'd gone the right way, and that you were within sight of land. I mean, of course, they're made of chalk, which is underneath a lot of the southern part of the British Isles, the southern part of England. If you dig down through the grass and the soil, you hit chalk. And chalk is evidence that once upon a time, the rock of which this island is made was under the sea, because chalk is laid down by little tiny organisms which have chalk in their makeup. When they die, the chalk gradually settles to the seabed. And after millions of years and trillions upon trillions of these little creatures dying and sinking to the seabed, you end up with many meters deep of chalk. That's what chalk is. It's the things left behind by little dead animals. It's a reminder that once upon a time the stuff of the British Isles was underwater. So Dover used to be called the key to England. You know, for would-be invaders, they wanted to get to Dover and start the conquest, if they could, of Britain from that point. You know, as recently as World War II, you know, famously, the Battle of Britain was fought to stop Hitler being able to send ships across the English Channel, you know, to land in Dover and Kent and begin the invasion of Britain. And that's always been a worry for people who were in control of England. You needed to be in control of Dover. So the castle that's there today, Dover Castle, that was built by Henry II, King Henry II, in the 12th century. That's the 1100s. And during the Napoleonic era, and then again during the Second World War, use was made of tunnels carved into the chalk. You know, people were down in the rock for safety and for security, you know, as part of the defence of Britain against the French and then against Germany. It's always been a crucial part of Britain thinking about defending itself. You know, so Dover is so thick and deep with history. As a result, you know, people, it's a stepping stone into this part of the world. And so it has, some of those footprints are very deep indeed, and they hark back to a very distant time. And while the broad destination for this part of the trip is Dover, it's really about a boat. And the boat is called the Dover Boat because it was found by archaeologists in an excavation in Dover, and it now resides in the Dover Museum. And I could say, really with my hand on my heart, that the Dover Boat is the single best archaeological artefact I have ever seen. But by some way, it's out in front by a considerable gap. I've never forgotten it. I've seen it a couple of times in the museum, and it haunts my imagination. It's extraordinary. And it's about, 3,500 years old. It was made and used by people about 1,500 years BC, before the birth of Christ. Okay? Now, it was found, 1992 was the date. Archaeologists had been called in because a new stretch of road was being built between Dover and Felixstowe, I think, or Folkestone. It was a new road was being built. And so there was various bits of the ground had to be checked by archaeologists to see if there was anything valuable. And part of it, it was quite deep. It was going to be an underpass, a pedestrian underpass underneath the new road. So quite a deep hole had been excavated, and archaeologists were down checking to see if there was anything of historical or archaeological value. And they found some of the usual stuff that you would expect, you know, bits of medieval town wall and, you know, bits and pieces of Roman pottery. The sort of thing that's expected, you know, in a beneath a modern town in England, you generally expect to find medieval stuff and then Roman stuff and so on. So far so familiar. But it was what's called a rescue excavation, which is to say they were doing it as quick as possible, because obviously the developers of the road were paying for all this, and so there's no hanging about. So they want the archaeologists to get in and get it done as fast as possible. And typically, it so often happens on rescue excavations like that, or hurried excavations, just as they were coming to the end of their time, the time available, they noticed wood sticking out of a side of the hole. And in the rain, they started, you know, checking it, realising that they were sort of working against the clock. and they realised that it was ancient timber, and not a, it wasn't a dead tree, it was an ancient boat that had lain buried in the mud, in the sediment beneath the town, for, as it turned out, 3,500 years. Okay? So there's now a big effort has to kick in to get this thing out. In its entirety, it's estimated that the actual Dover boat, the vessel that people had used for, and they were probably using it to go back and forth across the English Channel or across the North Sea, it was about 60 feet long.
Wow, so it was big.
Considerable, yeah, considerable. Made of oak, and it's what archaeologists call a sewn plank boat. Which is to say, it's not like a dugout canoe, you know, where you take a tree trunk and hollow it out and use that. Neither is it the more familiar idea of planks that have been put together with wooden dowels or indeed rivets or nails. It's a clinker built in that familiar, you know, rowing boat style. It had been made, the people, the craftsmen who had fashioned this thing, had brought together four huge planks of oak, and they had carved them and shaped them, brought them together, and then made holes all the way along and literally sewn them together with what are called withies. And that's little thin branches of something flexible like willow, a kind of material that's quite bendy. So holes are made, and then you push through these withies, and then you tie or sew the boat together using the willow as a kind of thread or rope. And so this holds the planks in place. And obviously it's not the most effective way of making something that's watertight. You know, there's gaps. And into the gaps you put caulking, which was probably like moss, another material packed into the gaps and held there with resin, you know, obtained from other timber. But the thing, in its pristine, just made condition, it would always have leaked. You know, so you've now got a 60 foot long vessel, into which you can get quite a lot of people and quite a lot of cargo. But imagine taking that across the English Channel. You know, we've all seen footage of migrants and asylum seekers trying to get across the English Channel in one sort of precarious craft after another. And we know how dangerous potentially that crossing can be. And so imagine being in this thing that leaks anyway. So anybody that's in it and on a journey, quite a few people are probably sitting there with balers of one kind or another, just constantly bailing it out, you know, to keep the water from filling up the hull. So, but nonetheless, it's an amazing vessel to have. And it by its existence, it makes us think about somebody who had the wherewithal and the authority to make it happen. So somebody important wanted this, because he had to organise the craftspeople, he had to get the materials gathered together, and then once he had it, or she had it, you needed. There's no evidence within the Dover boat of a mast, so they didn't sail it, they rowed it. So you've got a team of people, strong people, rowing with oars. So this individual also had to rely on strong people that you could employ to row this vessel back and forth, okay? So it's a considerable item. So a bit leaky, a bit precarious or not, it was an extremely valuable piece of kit. And given that it's 3,500 years old, that means it was made and used during the Bronze Age. And because it's down there in the south of England, it may well have come into play for people who were transporting copper and tin back and forth. That might have been how some of the, you know, tin from Cornwall, copper from Wales and elsewhere might have been part of the cargo that was back and forth, along with other things like livestock, you know, crops, seeds, whatever, all, fabrics, all the other things, skins from animals, fleeces from sheep, moving back and forth across the water. Okay, so having a vessel that could let you do that gives you great status. You're international now. You know, you're not someone who's stuck on the island. You can come and go, and you can obtain things from far away, or bring people. You know, the sort of people that want to come to this part of the world. You know, they need it's like a ferry. So it would be put to all manner of use. It's an incredible thing, and it's 3,500 years old. So it begs the question, why did the archaeologists find it where they found it? You know, what's going on there? Well, when they... And it was the devil's own job to get it out. It was like an impacted wisdom tooth. It was really stuck in this clay mud, rain coming down. The archaeologists had to struggle. And eventually they had to satisfy themselves with just taking half. They took about 30 feet of it out and left the other half like a broken tooth still stuck in the ground there to this day. Okay, it's now buried deep underground under the new motorway. And even the bit they got out, they had to cut it into 10 pieces and then reassemble it in the museum. And it had been stopped from you know, decaying by the waterlogged clay in which they found it. But as soon as they got it out, it immediately started to dry out and it would have just turned to dust. So what they did was they dipped the pieces in wax and then used a process that was a bit like freeze-drying. They freeze-dried it, and it's basically preserved for all time. Inside Dover Museum, where you go and see it, it's in a kind of a specially built glass display room, like a big glass chamber. And inside, it's specially air-conditioned and so that all the conditions are required to stop time and stop this thing from decaying. So they get the thing out, and it's now on display. But once they had it out, they were able to also look at the circumstances in which it had been held for all of those thousands of years. And the archaeologists were able to see that it had been lying in what had once been a quite shallow stream or river. They could see that. They could see the shape. And it had been on the bottom of a shallow river. So the boat had sunk. Okay? It had ended up on the bottom of a river. And then all the intervening centuries had filled it in and the river had dried up and it was now just deep underground. So why did it sink? Was there an accident with this boat? Well, as it turns out, no. Because you can see where the withies that were holding the planks together, at some point, they were deliberately cut through. And you can see, like a rope that's been cut with a sharp knife, you can see the cuts. So it was deliberately scuttled. That's the word that's used to describe a ship that's been, you know, deliberately sunk. So at some point, this incredibly useful 60-foot-long vessel that would transport you back and forth across to the continent, the people who owned it decided to sink it. They rowed it up a river, they got out, and they used their bronze axes and knives to cut the withies so that the water got in and it sank to the bottom of the river. Now, that's bonkers, isn't it? You'd say, well, what motivates such an act? Well, in truth, we can't ever properly know. You could probably come up with as many explanations for that as there are, you know, as there are people. It's incredibly difficult to know. But an abiding, a strong suggestion is that it was sacrificed. Okay? So the people who had it, the person who owned it, at one point after it's having been of use to him and his people, he became aware of a debt that he ought to give it back. Having had the use of it, he was now in debt to the future. Okay, now that's an important concept to have. You know, we can take concepts like the future for granted because you grow up being told about the future. But people have to arrive at those concepts for themselves at some point in the past. And so the Dover boat and the scuttling, the sacrifice of it, points at a time when people were beginning to think that by surrendering items of value now, they might be rewarded by the future when the future arrived. They could conceive of the future being another world that was travelling towards them through time. And an idea had developed whereby people felt that if they gave up important things, the future might be kind to them, so that when it arrived, it would reward them. So this might explain why we find dropped into rivers and lakes valuable things from the past, like swords and jewellery all kinds of items. Even to this day, people put coins in wishing wells in the hope that by doing that, they'll get luck. It's a very, very old idea. And always, almost always, when we find the knives and the swords and the spearheads and the jewellery, before it was deposited into the bog or into the river or into the lake, they've usually been bent and broken. So there's a process by which, right, we as people, we've had use of this item for long enough. Now it becomes the property of the future or the property of the gods. And so they put it beyond the use of people by breaking it. And then they let it go, and from that point on, it belongs to someone else. So likewise with the Dover boat, it wasn't enough just to leave it by the side of the river. They had to destroy it, put it beyond human use, so that it then made the kind of transition into the world of the gods, or the world of the ancestors, or the world of the future. So this is what the Dover boat represents. I was allowed into the glass box. Okay, generally speaking, you look at it from outside, but you know, because of the kind of job that I've been doing, I get in amongst these things, get to touch them. And by looking at the wooden planks, you can see the evidence of its making. You can see where sharp axes and whatever have been used to make to shape the oak planks. And you can see how the withies, these bits of willow sapling, have been, you know, pushed through these holes and fixed and tied in knots. You can see the process of how the thing was made 3,500 years ago. And then, of course, you can see where the withies were cut. So you can see people deciding, right, now's the time, this is the moment. And maybe all at once, maybe they surrounded it, all the warriors, maybe with a sharp knife in their hands. And all in a moment, they said, right, one, two, three. And they cut it as though putting it to death, as though they were cutting its throat or ending its life. And then they would have stepped back from it as those planks kind of separated and the water filled it from below. And then they would have watched it disappear out of sight, gone forever. And there it lay. You know, for a while it was in a river, and then something happened and the river silted up and became just mud. And then more passage of time, and then it was eventually buried beneath Roman Dover, then medieval Dover. All the periods of history that we think about came and went. And then modern Dover came. And all the while that's been happening, all the kings and queens, all the empires, all the wars, all the happiness and suffering, all the joy, all that's happened while that boat was lying there, waiting, sleeping, lying where it had been sent 3,500 years ago. And then in 1992, some people stumble across it and it comes back into the world. But if you go and see it, you can sense all of that. And I swear to you, I mean, I'm a modern, sensible, rational person, but when I was in the glass box with it, all the hairs went up on my neck and on my arms, and I felt as if I wasn't just in that cabinet with something. I felt briefly as if I was in that cabinet with someone. I felt that there was someone there, and I almost expected to be haunted. I almost expected to hear a voice or to see, because the thinking of the people was so present in that space, it meant that the people were almost there. The people who had thought those thoughts, performed those acts, because the evidence of what they had done was so visible, it felt as though they had done it 30 seconds before I stepped into the space. It was very, very strange. I'll never forget it. I'll never forget being in that glass room with that boat. It's an extraordinary thing.
It's so well preserved, you can actually see the marks the Bronze Age shipbuilders were making.
Oh.
But is there enough of it left that you can actually tell it's a boat?
Yes, it has the shape of a canoe. It's long and thin. And the space inside for sitting in or for putting in cargo is relatively shallow. So think of a longboat, like a canal boat, or a big canoe. And it's four long planks of oak, four huge pieces of timber that have been brought two on each side and meeting in a kind of a shallow V shape. It doesn't have a keel, it just the four meet, and then it's all been sewn together all the way along by these sort of big looping stitches of willow. And you can see that, it, obviously, because it was in the ground for such a long time, it's stained. It's a dark, it almost looks like polished black metal. It's very, very dark. But that's the only difference. You can still see that it's timber, and you can still see the willow, and you know what you're looking at. It's just that it has been stained darkly by the mud and the clay and the sediment that it's been that have preserved it for all of those thousands of years, and also part of the conservation process has probably added to that effect. So it looks slightly otherworldly, and it carries like an invisible cargo all of the thought that went into it. You know, if you look at it for long enough, gradually you realise, you can perceive what you're looking at. The cut ends, the marks in the wood of it being carved into shape with sharp knives and with axes and adzes, that, you know, by craftsmen, shipbuilders. I mean, it's a product of shipbuilders 3,500 years ago, you know, that have made this thing. And you can see it, and it's all there kind of carried within it. The Dover boat still has an invisible cargo. And it's a cargo of the imagination and the creativity and all the thoughts of the people that made it, used it, and then eventually thought, well, the time's come. We have to give this back. And I'm haunted by how old or how long ago people began accepting that they couldn't just keep on taking and having, that there's a price. People, for whatever reason, they obviously became preoccupied by the thought that we've got this, but what if we don't deserve it? And what if we take too much? What if we take too much tin or too much copper or gold and we run out? You know, what if there comes a year when the crops just don't grow? Or there is no more flint, or there is no more metal. Or what if the sea comes and it takes away the land, like at Cantre'r Gwaelod, or as you see at Haysborough, where the million-year-old footprints are? People had a long understanding that from time to time things got taken away. And it's almost as though it began to prey on everyone's mind. What can we do? Are we impotent in the face of the inevitable? Or are there things that we could be doing, ways we could be living, behaviours we could adopt that might affect the future? That's an amazing thought, to think that if I do something now, the future might be better. That if I do something good, if I sacrifice something of great value to me, the future might notice and remember. So that when it arrives, it'll be good to me. And if it's not good to me, it might be good to my children or my grandchildren. And I find that haunting. You know, with things like, you know, Extinction Rebellion, people worried about climate change and sea levels rising and global warming, and people have this angry sense that someone somewhere has done something wrong and we're going to be punished for it. That feeling is there. We've made a mess. We've taken too much. We've burnt too much oil. We've burrowed out too much coal. And now look what's happened. Now there's a reckoning. You know, a lot of people feel that there's a reckoning, that someone's come to settle the account, and it's nature herself has come to settle the account. And what are we going to lose? What's going to be taken from us? And that's just the continuation of a worry, an anxiety that some people have had for a very, very long time. What can we do? What can we do now to make then better?
So these ancient ancestors of ours were thinking about the future and their place in it. They were working together and setting up sophisticated trading routes and commerce. It was 4,500 years ago, but it doesn't feel that different from today.
Ah, and they were doing it in the same place. You know, we're still, even in the 21st century with Amazon and you know, and online shopping and all the rest of it, the bulk of the things that we need here, they still come in through Dover. It's where most people come and go from. And the other ports that are basically around that tail end of England, that's still where the boats come in. You know, that the importance for the same reason has never gone away. And the roads, so many of the roads that we use today in Britain, up and down the spine of England, the roads that go into Scotland, the roads that go into Wales, you know, in a lot of cases they're on top of Roman roads, or they're following the same line as Roman roads, and that's 2,000 years ago. But the fact is, the Roman roads were following ways, tracks that were already ancient. That was already the way north. That was already the way west. You know, all we have done, or all that anyone has done in the intervening centuries and millennia, is come up with a more modern version of the same thing. And lo and behold, the Dover boat, which is it's actually physically in the same location as the world's busiest ferry port. Well, 3,500 years ago, there was a ferry, if you like, made out of oak, sewn together with willow withies. And the people had it and used it for the same thing, getting across to France, bringing something back. It's amazing.
It's extraordinary when you talk about the layers of history hidden beneath our cities and our feet. And we find this, the oldest known seafaring boat ever discovered in the world. But it could so easily have been missed.
Yes, it was purely by chance. No one was looking for it. No one had any reason to expect it was there, and it was coming right at the end of a long and, you know, frankly, quite uninspiring archaeological rescue dig that hadn't really found anything that of any great surprise. And then, lo and behold, just as the dig was winding up, somebody said, "Oh, hey ho, there's a bit of wood over there. Let's have a look at that." We could have missed it. Yeah, and so there would have been many vessels like it. You know, it's important not to think that it was the only one. That one has come up by chance in that location. Well, likewise, at that time, there would have been other vessels of a similar design, plying back and forth across the channel, bringing cargoes of valuable things, valuable people. And it was just, that's just the one that we accidentally discovered. It might be the only one we ever find, but it stands for all the others that we haven't found.
But they had to leave half the boat behind. Couldn't the road have been paused to allow the whole excavation?
Too difficult. It was going to involve bringing in all sorts of other machinery. We were lucky to get out what we got.
Really?
Don't be a glasses half empty about this. Be glasses half full. It's humbling and breathtaking and just awe-inspiring.
How is it that objects like this have the power to take us right back to the Bronze Age?
It's almost like a paradox that, on the one hand, we talked in another podcast about the little bit of horse rib bone that was found in Robin Hood's cave in Cresswell Crags. It's tiny, it's like 3 or 4 inches long, but it has on it this beautiful little engraving of a horse's head and its plunging forelegs. And so on the one hand, you've got a tiny little artifact with a horse on it. But what it really is, what has really been preserved and what has survived for, well, in the case of that little bit of bone, you know, maybe 10, 12, 13,000 years, is thought. There's nothing more fleeting and momentary than a thought, an idea. And you wouldn't expect an idea to be preserved like a flint tool or a bone or a wooden boat. So the magnetic force that's really kept me fascinated by archaeology is, it's not that you find a rib bone with a horse's head on it or a boat. It's the fact that by holding that in your hand or looking at it or being in the presence of it, you realise that what's really been preserved is the way that people thought. The artist, the man or the woman, had to think that up, had to find the bit of bone, polished the surface till it was smooth and clean, selected a tool, thought about what he or she was going to draw, and then drew it. So, and that's all preserved. Someone thought it up. And on a bigger scale, but not more or less important, the Dover boat shows you people thinking. We want to get from here to there. How are we going to do it? And I don't want it to just be something that can take you or just me. I want it to be something that's big. I want to bring back lots of stuff, or I want to take lots of people. And then, so you can see all of that. And then you find that they deliberately destroyed it. They unmade it. Having made it and used it, they then unmade it. And you see that because they cut the withies and they let it fall apart and they watched it sink. All of that, that's activity spread out possibly across years. You know, let's imagine the thing was maybe in use for 20 years. Well, that's all there. What's amazing to me is that individual artefacts carry all of that. That thought, the most fleeting, the most ephemeral thing you can imagine, you can find it in a hole in the ground. You can excavate and find and keep thought. I find that extraordinary.
And today, when you go to Dover to catch the ferry to France, if you go via the museum, you'd be able to see how our ancestors did it 4,500 years ago.
Yeah.
Then go and hop on your ferry.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but, you know, as far as I'm concerned, in the presence of certain things, in as much as it will ever be possible, you can time travel. You know, to me, you know, people make up movies and tell stories and about travelling through time. And it may or may not be possible, who knows, depending on which physicist you listen to. But you can do a version of it. Because if you go to the Dover boat, thoughts that people had 3,500 years ago are still in the room. What more do you want? Magical dark lake, home to ritual, ceremony, and to an ancient way of life. A time when an elite group of thinkers wielded power and influence right across the British Isles to Gaul and beyond. Our ancestors' wisdom and reflections of another world brought to life by an incredible hoard of treasure. Next time, in my love letter to the British Isles. Check out my Instagram account, Neil Oliver Love Letter. And to ensure you get each new episode of the podcast as it goes live, don't forget to subscribe, write a review, and share with your friends. For further reading about these favourite destinations of mine, you could try my book. It's called The Story of the British Isles in 100 Places, and it's published by Transworld. Neil Oliver's Love Letter to the British Isles is produced by Paul Ratcliffe and Neil Oliver for Fat Belly Films. The music is the work of Malcolm Goldie. The social media producer is Oscar CFR. All of the additional research was conducted by Evie, Lucian, Archie and Teddy. Finance was taken care of by Catherine and Trudy. Post-production was the effort of Allthorpe Studios. The photography is by Neil R. And the graphics are by Paul Plowman. And special thanks to the people across history who have made and continue to make these isles such an incredible place. This has been an FBF podcast production.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.